The museum's code of ethics is above all intended to help museum professionals to resolve operational and management problems that they face day in, day out. I'm quoting from their own introduction. Which is to say that it is essentially a practical rather than a rigorously philosophically based code. As an example of what seems to me somewhat loose drafting, I might cite, for example, paragraph 7.11, there is a copy in the audience somewhere, so do sort of pass some around when you've had a brief look at it. Paragraph 7.11, for example, calls on museums to uphold and comply with conditions set by benefactors and accepted by the museum unless changed circumstances mean that conditions need to be reconsidered in the light of what is generally held to be in the public interest. It seems to me that that leaves quite a lot of leeway, and it also leaves a great deal of matter for potential discussion, particularly about the nature of the public interest. So it seems that although it's called a code of ethics, we are actually looking at a code of practice. And as I will go on to argue, it seems to me that this is not the only time when the use of words is a little bit loose. The code actually says at one point quite explicitly the spirit of the code is as important as the letter. And again, I imagine that lawyers, philosophers can have a lot of fun with that. This is not to say that the code is without considerable use for museum professionals. One particularly important tip which I would invoke now is that museum staff are encouraged to avoid being seen as representing the museum if speaking personally. And that is advice which I take very much to heart and put into practice now. It's important to distinguish my personal opinions from those of the Ashmolean, or indeed from those of the University of Oxford. So what I'm saying comes with no authority whatever. These are merely the random thoughts of an aging museum curator. Now, while I point out some of the problems which it seems to me relate to this museum's association code, it's important for me to emphasise that the Ashmolean, like all United Kingdom museums, obeys this code with the utmost care for reasons which will become apparent. And mostly I agree wholeheartedly with the code. Though I have to say that others may disagree with elements which are not necessarily the elements that I am inclined to take issue with. For example, there is an injunction in the code which calls on us to develop and promote the museum to appeal to an ever broader and more varied audience. Now, this is something I agree with completely. It was very much one of the drivers of the recent redevelopment of the Ashmolean. But I have to say, in the course of the redevelopment of the Ashmolean and subsequently, it has been made painfully obvious to us that there are various people within the university who are deeply distressed that the Ashmolean should open its doors and arrange its displays with a view to attracting a wide audience. They would much rather that we concentrated our displays and all our efforts on serving the needs of the university's teachers and students. And there's a clear conflict here. I believe that it's a conflict which the museum has been able to resolve, because we take the view that in the galleries, in the main areas of display, we are very definitely attempting to broaden our appeal and reach an ever wider and more varied audience. However, in the study rooms, which are in the new building, arranged next door to the stores, these are available for the university's staff, teachers and students, and indeed to members of the general public, on application. So you have only, the university's staff have only to mention to us that they would like to bring a class in to look at a particular series of objects, and not only do they get to examine them much more closely, they can handle them, they can pick them up, they can pass them around, they can talk about them, and they can ask for specifically what they want, rather than having to rely on what happens to be on display. So my own feeling is that this is a very successful way of squaring this particular circle, of dealing with this potential conflict between the requirements of the university and the possible wishes of a much larger audience. And so far, I'm happy to say that we do seem to be attracting a much larger audience than we've ever had before. Partly, of course, I'm sure this is about publicity. It's been in the news, and so people are aware of it. But I'm also confident that more people are coming back on repeat visits because they enjoyed their previous visits than used to be the case. As I say, this particular policy is very much in line with the museum's code of ethics, as the one that I have circulated to you. And I think I probably haven't explained, which I should have done, that this code of ethics is produced by the Museums Association, which is the professional body which the government now, it never used to, but the government does use to govern and to govern the profession as a whole. So it comes with a fair degree of authority, and in this particular case, I'm very happy with what it says. I'm not entirely sure that every professor in the university is. However, the code also requires me to promote this code of ethics for museums, apparently even when I disagree with it. I'm obliged by the code, on the other hand, to promote diversity of views in interpretation of objects. But it would seem I'm not obliged to promote diversity of views in interpreting the code. There is clearly a degree of inconsistency here, which I don't think is likely to trouble me or anybody else, but it's worth noting in passing. And certainly anybody, I think, working in a museum would hesitate, in a university, would hesitate to accept an obligation to promote views that they disagree with. Nonetheless, it seems that's what we are required to do by the Museums Association Code, and by extension, by the British government, and indeed any number of central and central government funds which the museum receives are dependent on us signing up to the Museums Association Code of Ethics, which includes the requirement to promote that code. I like to think, you'll be able to tell me if I can get away with this, that I am indeed promoting the code by inviting a more detailed examination and discussion of it. Can I get away with that? Well, we'll see. In short, I have very little doubt that a lawyer or indeed a philosopher would rip the code of ethics for museums to shreds in pretty short order. But it does try to be a practical guide to museum staff and to governing bodies through various potential minefields, and these are many. And there is a real need for guidance and advice of a general sort which addresses some of the more recurrent problems that assail museums today. There's a huge amount in the code which I think is good and practical and sensible, and my museum and all others in Britain have to follow it anyway. Many funding streams depend on it, and we accept it as such. It's probably fair to say that there are three big issues which come up fairly often. One of them concerns the disposal of collections. This is a painting by Sir Alfred Munnings called After the Race, which I believe is still part of the collection in the Southampton Art Gallery. But Southampton have expressed an interest in selling this painting and one or two others in order to fund a £5 million shortfall for their planned Titanic Centre, or I think it's called a Museum of the Sea, or I forget the exact details. I also, I'm ashamed to say, I forget to I haven't been able to ascertain exactly what the position is about this proposal. I do know that under the museum's code, it's necessary for any museum intending to dispose of its collections in this way to seek the approval of the Museums Association Ethics Committee, who will look at this and test any proposals of this sort against a number of criteria. For example, the code encourages people, it enjoins people to refuse to undertake disposal principally for financial reasons, except for what they describe as the long-term public benefit which may be derived from the remaining collections. And there are other various categories of which the Ethics Committee is called upon to look at in this context. I have to say, when this was being discussed at the Museums Association annual conference, the Oxford University Museums opposed the change to the rules that would allow the disposal of collections in this way. We took the view that, looking at past experience, it's almost always better not to dispose of items. There are worrying examples in the past when, indeed, Oxford Museums and many others have disposed of items, but looked in retrospect at the matter and regretted that they did part with various things. Sometimes they got their understanding of the objects wrong. They didn't really know what they were surrendering. There's also a particular concern that if you sell your collections, let's not beat about the bush here. If you sell your collections, this is highly likely to undermine the confidence of donors, past, present, and future. Not unnaturally, if I was thinking about giving something to a museum, and I knew that museum had, in the past, sold items from its collection which it had lost interest in order to fund some new development, I might be inclined to think again. And that was certainly the line that the Oxford Museums took in opposing this change to the rules. On the whole, it's probably fair to say that we didn't oppose it with any very great energy, not least because there's no requirement to sell your collections. You don't have to do it. And so the change in the rules was notional in some sense, and it was a perfectly simple matter for those museums who didn't approve of it not to do it. But I do think that there is a very real concern that opening the door to the disposal of collections in this way leaves collections at the mercy of penurious local authorities or even hard-pressed universities. It's not very many years ago since Royal Holloway sold some paintings. Now, in that case, of course, they were held not by a museum but by the college itself. And it was perhaps arguable on their part that the ownership of these paintings was not part of their core mission. However, that is an argument which disturbs museum staff within universities, because the same could be said of the whole of all our museums, that they are not part of the core mission of the university, which is teaching and research, even though all the university's museums are energetic in the teaching and the research which they conduct. So the argument that it's not part of the core mission is one that that I am not hugely comfortable with. There is another element in this particular topic, which is summed up in the expression "too much stuff," which was chosen as a title of a review carried out and led actually by the director of the V&A shortly to become Master of St. Cross College here in Oxford in the autumn. That's to say Mark Jones. He produced a report which recognised the very real difficulties which storage and care of collections present. And many museums are in a situation, effectively, of being unable to acquire new material because they've got nowhere to put it, because they have so much existing material. And this report actually did encourage, it's called deaccessioning, but generally, I think, not in terms of encouraging the sale of collections, but more deliberately with a view to sharing collections from museums that had too much stuff, making their stores available to other museums which might be in a position to exhibit some of that material. And there are absolutely no doubt that many museums, including the Ashmolean, but of course particularly the big national museums, have a huge amount of material which they do not exhibit, which might be welcome as exhibition items in other museums across the country. It's a very nice idea. It's not easy and it's not cheap. Lending items is highly desirable. Most museums do quite a lot of it, particularly for special exhibitions. But nobody should imagine that this is easy or straightforward or can be done without very significant expenditure, because to do the thing properly requires all sorts of insurance and top quality art removal companies and a whole load of additional paraphernalia. So it's not that easy. But it's a good idea. It's a good idea when it can be achieved. So much for disposal of collections. Another big topic, which again I shall deal with relatively briefly, concerns the much vexed matter of human remains. I have generally speaking, when the question of human remains is brought up, my ethical response is to ask Micah Hanlon. He's the university's nominated czar, I suppose, in the matter of human remains. And on the whole, in this, as actually in almost anything, I do what Mike says. Now, there are very, very serious and difficult issues here. Some of the problems that arise actually have come as unlooked for consequences of legislation which was brought in the aftermath of the discovery of the use of human remains in hospitals without the permission of the families of the people concerned. And you may recall some years ago it was discovered that body parts were being kept for research, in itself a highly laudable idea, but this was done in some cases without the permission of the families concerned, and caused a very great deal of grave disquiet. As a consequence of that, a regime of a demanding regime of licensing was introduced. And I think when this was introduced, it wasn't really recognised at first that these laws would also bear on human remains kept in museums. Often, of course, because the human remains are centuries, indeed often millennia old, it's less difficult. But the topic remains extremely sensitive, and there are key questions concerning respect for the dead and respect for surviving communities who wish to safeguard their ancestors' remains. And, of course, you'll be aware that there are many communities. One thinks of Maoris and many other communities who have real issues and seek repatriation for human remains which have been kept in museums in this way, and indeed in some cases displayed in museums in this way. So repatriation is a serious topic which arises and which grows out of this. Now, as I say, I'm not in any sense an expert on the topic of human remains, but I think it's important possibly just to flag this up as one of the particularly sensitive issues which we have to deal with at the moment. Like many people who aren't experts, I sort of Googled it this afternoon, actually. And I have to say, I was appalled to discover that along the right-hand side of the computer screen came up the injunction, human ashes on eBay for less, it offered. I was so disconcerted, I didn't actually click it. I thought, hang on, you know. But it's an illustration of the world that we're concerned with. Repatriation, of course, is a huge topic in its own right, and that brings us on more to the main topic and where I'm going to spend most of the rest of my time, which concerns the handling and the treatment, indeed, often the acquisition of other nations' cultural patrimony. Now, this is a huge topic. Incidentally, if you Google illicit trade, on the right-hand side, you can also discover marital affair dating as an invitation, which, again, I have to say, I didn't click. But you do have to be careful with Google. And this, of course, was no doubt triggered by the word illicit, which is an interesting word, which I will come to in the course of this discussion. There's a real problem about the robbing of archaeological sites, fueling a trade in antiquities, which is deeply regretted and much criticised, and indeed outlawed by the Museums Association Code. And I will look at this in a bit more detail. We would all, I think, have enormous sympathy with less developed, less wealthy countries who see their assets being stripped, their cultural assets being stripped by wealthy nations or individuals. And there are many high-profile scandals. This is a book which I have to say I haven't read, but essentially it's all about this particular topic relating to some material acquired, as they argue, improperly by the Getty Museum. And it used to be the case that American museums were much more unconcerned about these issues of ethical acquisition. In truth, of course, museums in Britain and in Europe at large used not to give this much thought. But certainly in Britain and Europe in the 1990s and more recently in America as well, there is a strong tide of concern about the inappropriate acquisition of other countries' cultural patrimony. Now, in Cambridge, the MacDonald Institute, and particularly Colin Renfrew, have led a vigorous campaign with considerable success, using Lord Renfrew's political influence, to put a stop to this trade in other people's cultural belongings. There's a book, I might pass it round. This is part of Renfrew's argument, setting out the problem, the difficulties, with numerous examples of improper acquisition of archaeological material. Now, the Museums Association Code tries to guide museum staff through this particular minefield. And most of it, if you happen to be the one with the person who's got the code in front of you now, most of it is to be found in Section 5. But I think there's another separate book which is just about acquisitions, and then there's another book which is about something else as well. But anyway, Section 5 is concerned with the acquisitions, and broadly speaking, it requires everybody to reject items of dubious provenance. The point being here that if you have a clear provenance, if you know where something's come from, it's very easy to ascertain whether it has been illegally excavated or indeed stolen from its owners or whether it has been illegally exported from its country of origin. And museum staff are required to exercise due diligence whenever they contemplate acquiring an item. And that applies whether they are acquiring an item by gift or as a bequest or as a loan or whether they're buying it. The code requires you to operate the same principles however it comes. So it's not just a matter of if you're buying it, you have to operate the same concerns if somebody wants to give you something. There specific mention of items wrongfully taken during a time of conflict. And of course, in the recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, these are, of course, particularly relevant concerns. There's naturally a requirement to reject items which are believed to be stolen. We're told reject any item if there's any suspicion that has been stolen, unless this is to bring it into the public domain in consultation with the rightful owner. And we're required to reject items which have been illicitly traded. We must reject any items about which there is any suspicion that it may have been stolen, illegally excavated or removed from a monument, site or wreck, contrary to local law or otherwise acquired in or exported from its country of origin, including the UK, or any intermediate country in violation of that country's laws or any national and international treaties. We are required to reject any item that lacks a secure ownership history, unless it was exported from the country of origin before 1970. And that date comes from the date of a UNESCO convention of that year. And the idea is that before 1970, it's too much had already happened, but in 1970, UNESCO began to draw attention to this issue. And that is the date which is chosen at the, as the cut-off point, if you like. So the rules are quite stringent. We're also required to decline to offer any expertise or otherwise assist the current possessor of any item that may have been illicitly obtained, unless it's to assist law enforcement or to support other organisations in countering illicit activities. And there are examples of the outstanding success of this general approach. A wonderful Gandharan Buddha has recently... Here it is. I've got a press cutting. This Gandharan Buddha was recently acquired from Japan by a British dealer, knowing it, believing it to be stolen from Gandhara. That's the area of, sort of, well, essentially, it's Afghanistan. He acquired it from a dealer in Japan, and he must have bought it, considerable expense, personal expense to himself, by arrangement with the British Museum, that it would be displayed in the British Museum, which again the British Museum would not normally have been permitted to display a stolen item. But this was all made legitimate by the enormous generosity of the dealer, because the item itself is intended to be returned to Afghanistan. Now, there are, of course, some problems about Buddhist items in Afghanistan, and I'll come on to those. Later, but I wouldn't wish to diminish my admiration for this particular arrangement. And I would point out the important role played by the British Museum in this and by the dealer, who I believe is not mentioned by name. He must be keeping it anonymous, which again redounds to his credit. So there are some good stories. There are some good stories of people doing righteous acts. However, I do have some problems with some aspects of this rather simplistic ban on acquisitions of uncertain origin. Now, I did actually speak about this at a conference here in Oxford in 2004, and I had forgotten about it, so I have little doubt that you either weren't here in 2004 or you've forgotten about it too. But it's in this volume, together with a number of other papers. The conference included people with views as diverse as Neil Brody of the MacDonald Institute in Cambridge, which is very deeply and energetically opposed to the acquisition of what they call illicit objects, on the one hand. There's also a paper there from George Ortiz, who's a distinguished and many people would say notorious collector of antiquities. And there were a number of other people who spoke at this meeting and published in the publication, which came out in 2006. The volume was edited by Eleanor Robson and two of our fellows, Luke Treadwell and Chris Gosden, now migrated to Keeble as a result of taking the chair. But he was a fellow here at the time. Now, I apologise in some sense for revisiting such old ground, but I do so in the belief that some of the unlooked-for consequences of the campaign against unprovenanced acquisitions are no more understood now than they were in 2004. So I think that these concerns deserve another hearing. There's also a paper which I shall summarise in this volume by Sir John Boardman, the former Lincoln Professor of Classical Art and Archaeology here in Oxford, who is extremely outspoken in his criticism of the Museum Association's current code. Well, actually, no, to be more precise, actually, he's very critical of Colin Renfrew's position. I don't think he addresses the Museums Association Code, but it's Lord Renfrew that he really takes issue with. Now, one of my concerns about what, for the sake of brevity, I'll call the Renfrew approach, is that, not to beat about the bush, it does seem to be underlaid by a hostility towards dealers and collectors, and indeed towards anybody, including museums, which collect. And in passing, I might make the slightly catty remark that the Museums Association is dominated by museums which don't actually collect, especially don't collect items from abroad. There are far more museums that look after purely local and British things in Britain than museums which continue to collect from other societies and cultures outside Britain. It's also quite interesting that the Museums Association Code goes a significant distance beyond where British law stops. There is a UK criminal law of 2003 which deals with what they call tainted cultural property. It doesn't attempt to cover illegal export from other countries, which the Museums Code does include, and the UK criminal law lays the burden of proof on the prosecution, as you would expect in any legal situation. But the Museums Code goes much further. It assumes that any object without a provenance is what they call illicit. And again, you have the suspicion that some of the archaeologists who most actively endorse Lord Renfrew's position tend to think that an item without a provenance, without a context, is useless anyway. So there are people who have said that quite clearly. So they would argue that you're not actually missing much because it hasn't got a provenance, it's no good to you anyway. Indeed, there are archaeological bodies that control archaeological journals of considerable importance that reject, she's gone early. It's all right, don't worry. reject for publication material without a provenance, even though it seems to many of us that actually putting this material on record would be enormously useful, both in order to identify its original source and to combat illegal trade. I'm quite interested in the word, in the use of the word illicit, which is a regular feature of the museum's association code and indeed of Lord Renfrew's approach. For me, illicit means illegal, but they don't use it in that sense. They use it to mean practices that they disapprove of, sometimes on very good grounds, but nonetheless they go beyond material which can be demonstrated to have been acquired or traded illegally. Because, as I said, the whole museum's code of ethics and Lord Renfrew's approach goes significantly beyond the legal. And it seems to me that the use of the word illicit is a piece of sleight of hand, which needs careful examination. The code bans the acquisition of objects without provenance on the assumption that they have been stolen. The law, in contrast, requires proof, there being no presumption of guilt to start with. So, as far as the code is concerned, absence of evidence that it's legal argues that it's illegal, or no, actually, to be fair, they don't say that. They say argues that it's illicit. I think the two words are interchangeable, but there we go. Whereas, of course, the law does not start with that presumption. And the code also bans objects which may have been illegally exported from other countries, which the law, the UK law, does not concern itself with. It's also interesting that the code describes objects as being illicit. And it seems to me that this can only be a practice, it's only the practice relating to the objects which can be illicit rather than the objects themselves, but perhaps I'm wrong. To me this seems a rather loose use of language, which George Orwell taught us long ago that we should be quite worried about. I have gone on rather a long time. I'd better hurry up. Another of my concerns is that the code drives a wedge between collectors and museums. Museums frequently have to reject gifts from collectors if the collector's items are legally acquired. The museums have to reject them if they are without provenance. And that, as I say, forces a distinction between museums and collectors, and if you look at the history of museums, museums over the centuries have actually benefited enormously from good relations with collectors who have selflessly, in many cases, given their collections to museums. So museums have to reject not just illegally acquired material, but anything which cannot be proved to be legally acquired. And in practice, of course, this calls for levels of documentation which in many cases simply didn't exist even 20 years ago. So there are real problems. There's also a tendency to shun dealers, despite the good offices of the guy who saved this Buddha. And Lord Renfrew is, I think he would admit, fundamentally hostile to all trade and all collecting. The only good collector, he says, is an ex-collector. And that gives me a bit of a problem, because collecting is vital for museums, as is recognised by the British government and indeed by the Museums Association. All museums professionals recognise the danger of the fossilisation of a collection if it doesn't continue to grow, if new material is not brought in to build our knowledge. The code also places an enormous reliance on the laws of foreign governments. And not all of these have shown themselves to be the best guardians of their own cultural heritage at the time. Afghanistan, of course, is the classic case in point. The Museums Association and UNESCO used to outlaw material coming out of Afghanistan. You weren't allowed to collect it, though quite a lot used to come out through Pakistan, but who were discouraged from collecting it, until the Taliban, of course, destroyed these famous Buddhas at Bamiyan. Now, UNESCO then had a change of heart and began to encourage museums to save Afghan material, and particularly they wanted to channel it to a centre which they approved of in Switzerland. But as I say, the British Museum has acted with its own considerable authority and on the generosity of this dealer to do a kind and generous act. This will, we are told, go back to Afghanistan. I have to say, hearing on the radio this morning about plans for the withdrawal of British and American forces, and actually whether they should have been in there is another matter, but with the prospect of the withdrawal of British and American forces and perhaps a change of regime in Afghanistan, one wonders if sending a Buddha back to Afghanistan is necessarily the best thing for that particular Buddha and that particular part of Afghanistan's own cultural heritage. These are thorny matters. Tibet is another example. The invasion of Tibet was repeatedly condemned by the United Nations. But UNESCO and the Museum Association Code of Conduct still prohibits the acquisition of Tibetan material, simply because its export is contrary to Chinese law. China, of course, the current authority in Tibet. So even though the Tibetan material is liable to destruction in China, which is keen to suppress Tibetan nationalism, under the law as it stands and under the code of practice as it stands, museums are discouraged from actually acquiring it, despite the entreaties of the Dalai Lama, who's desperately keen that museums should collect Tibetan material to save it and preserve it. Difficult issues. The Renfrew approach bans research on unprovenance material. And indeed effectively stopped the work of Oxford's own Research Laboratory for Art and Archaeology, which used to provide analysis which in many cases distinguished between forgeries and real items. The MacDonald Institute was unhappy about this because it seemed in some sense to be supporting the market in genuine items. It seems, I have to say, to me that this is an interesting and difficult issue because, of course, it's also a restraint on what I would regard as a perfectly respectable academic and scholarly inquiry. Is this thing genuine or isn't it? But as I say, it fell foul of Lord Renfrew's approach, who effectively prevented the Oxford Research Lab from continuing to do this. I ought to press on and move to a conclusion. The one thing I would say, I might canter through some of these pictures. Oh, that's a nice picture of the Hindu Kush and the valley where the Bamiyan Buddhas are or were. Coins are an interesting case as well because these are a very good example of items which have so much information on them and indeed were originally made and intended for exchange within and beyond the frontiers of the countries of their origin. That the requirement to secure a provenance for every coin which you acquire creates a good deal of difficulty and does unquestionably involve the loss of a huge amount of information which is actually written on the coin. You know, so much of the information about, so much of the context of a coin is written on it.
That in many cases, the fact that you don't have a provenance doesn't in any sense mean that, that it's not an interesting scholarly item, but it is nonetheless one which is very difficult for people to acquire in museums now. It's not completely impossible, because there is a little bit of leeway in the museum's code about what are called minor antiquities. And individual coins are generally spoken of as minor antiquities on the grounds that it's not unreasonable to think they might have been acquired legitimately and just nobody ever bothered to keep the provenance. And one of the most notorious cases, of course, concerns this treasure, which has been claimed, interestingly, by Lebanon and Croatia, as well as Hungary, where it probably comes from. Interesting example of what might be regarded as unethical practice by countries who actually could not have had any convincing evidence that the treasure came from their territory. This material has been effectively frozen since the 1980s. It was perhaps rather unwisely bought by the Marquis of Northampton, I think, but he's stuck with it now. Nobody can buy it or sell it. The museums, the British Museum can't handle it. They can't exhibit it. But it is extraordinarily important late Roman treasure. Now, I will perhaps cut short to give you a chance to make your contribution here. And I don't want to go on too long, but what I haven't done is actually give you a flavour of the really vigorous opposition to Lord Renfrew's position, which is in the volume that I pass around, made by Sir John Boardman. He, interestingly enough, points out, I mean, he says that despite being an archaeologist and being involved in archaeology for 50 years, he has scant regard for archaeologists as a profession. He says that archaeologists, through unpublished excavation, have done far more damage to to our cultural patrimony than tomb robbers, as indeed has ordinary agriculture and private and public roadworks and engineering. So he is highly critical of the archaeological establishment, and I recommend it to you. An unpublished site, he said, is even more of a destroyed site than the Bamiyan Buddhas, since no public record whatsoever is left. Rhys Carpenter famously commented that archaeologists do not always realise that they are burning the pages of history as they read them. I would judge that over the last 50 years, far less than 25% of the material and results of professional archaeological excavations have been properly published. It's vigorous stuff. But I think it's worth mentioning again, because as far as I'm aware, it's had no effect whatever on the Museum Association Code or on government practice. So I've tried to outline the formal position of the Museums Association, some of my worries about it, and finally, some of Sir John Boardman's outspoken criticisms. And I've cut that short, but it makes, as I say, interesting reading. The code is much more of a code of practice rather than a code of ethics, and I suspect that real progress might be made if we were able to tighten up the language and the thinking of the code. But that is a job for specialists in ethics rather than museums or archaeologists. So, over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Nick.